The question, dear friends, should a Catholic be elected to the presidency of the United States always arouses the sharpest controversy. And controversies which involve religion tend to become quite unrestrained and sometimes even venomous. The partisans in such a debate come to feel they are somehow defending not alone their interests in this world, in the here, but also their interest in the hereafter. And then memories of ancient wrongs and of past bitter controversies soon surge into the arena and bedevil the situation. And before long, the specific question at issue is lost sight of. And everyone is fighting in fine frenzy a host of ghosts and of goblins which have been conjured up by the overheated imaginations of men. It would appear to me that the simplest and most direct answer to the question, should a Catholic be elected to the presidency of the United States, might well be, why not? There is nothing in the Constitution of the United States which prohibits it. The Constitution of the United States is quite clear on this point. The framers of our Constitution, many of them of keen legal minds, as well as being great patriots, wanted to be very clear and specific on this point. And so they wrote into the Constitution of our country the following: no religious test shall ever be required as a qualification to any office or public trust under the United States. Words could not be more concise, more clear, more definitive. Our Constitution also has, as its First Amendment, the first article in the so-called Bill of Rights of the Constitution, the following: Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. Clearly, the framers of our Constitution did not want the United States to be either a Protestant country or a Catholic country or a Christian country. They did not wish to give preference to any religious body or to prevent the free exercise of any religion. They wanted this country, which they were helping to set up, they wanted it to be a secular state. They were not unfriendly to religion. Many of them were church members belonging to various denominations. They believed in God. and they wanted to build their new state upon the highest ethical and moral ideals of religion. But they also wanted to keep church and state separate and distinct, each free from the interference of the other in its legitimate sphere. They knew very well, because they were not far removed from it, they knew very well the evils and the strife and the bloodshed which were visited upon the old world, its governments and its peoples, when a specific church was officially recognized by government, when it received privileges which were denied to others, and where the free exercise of religion was denied or curtailed. The government which the founding fathers of our republic were setting up, they wanted to be different in many ways. Being so far removed from those days, we sometimes forget how different they wanted their new country to be. Their government would limit its own authority. It would pledge itself to respect certain basic rights which are inherent in each and every citizen as having been bestowed upon him, not by government or society or Congress, but by his Creator. And therefore these rights were to be inalienable, subject to no annulment and to no abridgment by government. They wanted government to limit itself. They wanted no political tyranny, even the political tyranny of a majority in a free democracy. And a written constitution would guarantee the individual citizen against the encroachment of government. And they wanted their government to be different in other ways. They would set up a system of checks and balances in government, so that neither the legislative branch, nor the administrative branch of the government, nor the judicial branch, would be in position to run away, as it were, with things, to precipitate an ill-considered action. And they also wanted that this government which they were setting up would not come to be dominated by any other body or any other organization, ecclesiastical or otherwise. They wanted their government to be free from the control of any other organism within the state. And their profound wisdom has stood the test of time, 170 years, the most turbulent and revolutionary years in the history of mankind. And because of that wisdom, our country has prospered, and no religion has suffered because of it. On the contrary, all religious bodies, from the extreme liberal to the extreme orthodox, well, in this country, and have thrived. And what is equally important, they have learned to live together and often to work together for the common good. Now, from time to time, zealous partisans of this or that religious body would challenge, indirectly of course, but would challenge nevertheless, the clear intent of the First Amendment. And they would try to whittle down its scope and meaning. And by means of interpretation, to give it openings whereby public funds, tax collected funds, would be used to support religious institutions on a non-preferential basis, of course. Thus, there are many Catholics, and perhaps members of other religious bodies, who would like federal funds used for the support of parochial schools. Now, it is not that these people really want a union of church and state. They have officially denied that. In 1948, Archbishop John T. McNichols, speaking explicitly on behalf of all the American Catholic bishops, stated, "We deny absolutely and without qualification that the Catholic bishops of the United States are seeking a union of church and state by any endeavor whatsoever, either proximately or remotely. If tomorrow Catholics constituted a majority in our country, they would not seek a union of church and state. They would then, as now, uphold the Constitution and all its amendments, recognizing the moral obligation imposed upon all Catholics to observe and defend the Constitution and its amendments." And I have no doubt that that is the position of the Catholic hierarchy of the United States and of Catholic laymen everywhere. But they would like to see, I believe many of them, a certain relaxation in the First Amendment, which would make it possible for federal government to support religious, educational schools. Now, these efforts, which have been made from time to time, have in the main been unsuccessful. Apart from certain fringe assistance given to the children attending parochial schools, and in my judgment, wisely given, such as participation in the federal school lunch program, or such matters as school buses, similar services, the basic principle of the separation of church and state has held good in its clear and original intent. In 1947, the Supreme Court of the United States proceeded to define more fully the intent of the First Amendment. And it declared, "Neither a state nor the federal government can set up a church. Neither can pass laws which aid one religion, aid all religions, or prefer one religion over another. No tax in any amount, large or small, can be levied to support any religious activities or institutions, whatever they may be called, or whatever form they may adopt to teach or practice religion. Neither a state nor the federal government can openly or secretly participate in the affairs of any religious organizations or groups, and vice versa. In the words of Jefferson, the clause against establishment of religion by law was intended to erect a wall of separation between church and state. And I believe that many Catholics in the United States fully accept this position. Recently, Senator Kennedy came quite close a few years ago to be nominated the vice presidential candidate of the Democratic Party, and is today being talked of as a possible presidential candidate. Senator Kennedy was questioned on this very issue, and he replied very clearly, and of course he's a Catholic, and a loyal Catholic, the First Amendment to the Constitution is an infinitely wise one. There can be no question of federal funds being used for support of parochial or private schools. It is unconstitutional under the First Amendment as interpreted by the Supreme Court. I am opposed to the federal government's extending support to sustain any church or its schools. As for such fringe matters as buses and lunches and other services, the issue is primarily social and economic and not religious. Each case must be judged on its merits within the law as interpreted by the courts. It is true that Senator Kennedy has been sharply criticized by some editorial writers in the Catholic press for this view which he expressed. And it is such criticism which disturb some non-Catholics in the United States, which raises doubts in their minds, as does the continued criticism of the church hierarchy because of the government failure to aid religious schools. But even those of us who are opposed to federal aid to parochial schools, whether they be Catholic or Protestant or Jewish, and there are Protestant parochial schools and Jewish parochial schools. I say even those of us who are opposed to federal aid to these schools, public funds being used to maintain them or support them, fail to see that all this has to do with the election of a Catholic to the presidency of the United States. A Catholic president, if elected, takes an oath of office prescribed by the Constitution of the United States. This oath of office reads, I do solemnly swear or affirm that I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States and will to the best of my ability preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. Now, what right have we to assume that a Catholic president will be less faithful to his oath, solemnly sworn, than a Protestant president would? There have been numerous Catholics who have been elected or appointed to high office in this nation and in its several states. Catholic governors, and congressmen, and senators, many of them elected in states where the majority of the electorate was Protestant. Supreme Court justices, chiefs of the United States Supreme Court, high-ranking military chiefs, important diplomats, and they have served with unimpeachable loyalty and integrity. And their religion and military caused them to subordinate the interest of their government to the interest of their church. In the heat of controversy, some have conjured up the so-called question of conscience, which presumably would supersede the oath of office, which an elected president, a Catholic elected president, would take. I am unable to follow this line of reasoning. When a man takes an oath to uphold the Constitution of the United States, he is in all conscience, committed to it. And if there's anything in the Constitution which the candidate finds contravening the church dogma, which he is obligated to accept, he cannot in all conscience either stand for office or take his oath of office if elected. There have been Catholics in office, public office and high office, who have opposed the church hierarchy on questions such as this of federal funds for parochial schools, or on such matters as the appointment of an ambassador to the Vatican. And they have not considered themselves, because of their position, either poor Catholics or disloyal to their church. I have quoted Senator Kennedy, who is among those who have registered their opposition to the appointment of an ambassador to the Vatican. Incidentally, both President Roosevelt and President Truman, both of them Protestants, favored representation at the Vatican. At the moment, it is the question of a Catholic president which arouses the opposition of some of our citizens. I recall the time, some years ago, when William Howard Taft was opposed for the presidency because he was a Unitarian. A Unitarianism, it was claimed, is not Christian, and this is a Christian country. The same arguments, the same religious arguments were used against Senator Herbert Lehman when he ran for governor of the largest state in our union, population point of view. That office belongs to a Christian. How can a Jew hold that office? Senator Lehman was elected to the office, re-elected, and again elected to that office, and finally was elected to the senatorship in the United States Congress. This argument, this religious argument, is a double-edged sword. It can strike in all directions and everywhere. It has been said that because the Catholic Church claims that it is the only one true church, that therefore a Catholic should not be elected to be President of the United States. I see no objection to the Catholic Church claiming that it is the one true church. Most religions claim the same thing. Just so long as it does not employ the power of government to enforce its claim, or ask for special privileges on that account, as is the case in some of the countries of Europe, unfortunately. Lovers of religious freedom cannot accept the thesis that a state which is overwhelmingly Catholic has a duty to protect this religious faith by controlling the public promulgation of non-Catholic doctrines or the public exercise of non-Catholic worship. This will never be accepted by those who believe in true religious freedom. Now, Catholic theologian may still subscribe to this thesis as a sort of an abstract proposition. Theory dies very hard, even when practice has made it obsolete. But in the United States, at least, this thesis, this doctrine, is one of those vestiges of the past, one of those sleeping dogmas which no responsible Catholic would advocate. Thirty years ago, a Catholic ran for the presidency of the United States on the Democratic ticket. A great and good man, Alfred E. Smith, governor of the state of New York. And bigotry and religious intolerance combined with other factors to defeat him. Some of the solid democratic states of the South, for the first time in their history, broke rank and deserted their party because of its Catholic candidate. And some of the same issues that are being talked about today were raised then, 30 years ago, in even louder and more outspoken terms than is now. I recall an open letter addressed to candidate Smith, written by a certain Charles A. Marshall, which appeared in the Atlantic Monthly. Mr. Marshall was a member of the Anglican Church, of the Episcopal Church, who was an authority on canon law. He addressed an open letter to candidate Alfred E. Smith, summarizing all the arguments against him because of his religion, to which Governor Smith replied in great detail in the same magazine in the issue of May 1927. I reread both letters in preparation for this address this morning. Mr. Marshall had quoted in his letter papal encyclicals, and church encyclopedias, and history, and built up a case for the necessary and inevitable conflict between religious loyalty to the Catholic faith and patriotic loyalty to the United States. In Governor Smith's reply, I was struck by two passages, especially by two passages. Governor Smith's reply was made, as he writes in his letter, after consultation with his dear friend, Father Francis P. Duffy, a man schooled in church law. And this is the first thought which struck me very much in the letter of Governor Smith. He wrote, "By what right do you ask me to assume responsibility for every statement that may be made in any encyclical letter? These encyclicals are not articles of faith. You seem to think that Catholics must be all alike in mind and in heart,
as though they had been poured into and taken out of the same mold.
And that's the mistake which people make, not alone about Catholics. It's the same mistake that's made about Jews. All Jews must act alike and think alike and react alike to any given situation. No diversity of opinion, no nuances. Governor Smith is a very loyal Catholic, raised in the parochial school, challenges that position. And I think his challenge would be subscribed to by thoughtful Catholics everywhere. Then I was deeply taken by the last paragraph in his letter, wherein he summarizes his creed as an American Catholic. He wrote, "I believe in the worship of God according to the faith and practice of the Roman Catholic Church. I recognize no power in the institution of my church to interfere with the operations of the Constitution of the United States or the enforcement of the law of the land. I believe in absolute freedom of conscience for all men, and in equality of all churches, all sects, and all beliefs before the law as a matter of right and not as a matter of favor. I believe in the absolute separation of church and state and in the strict enforcement of the provisions of the Constitution that Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. I believe that no tribunal of any church has any power to make any decree of any force in the law of the land other than to establish the status of its own communicants within its own church. I believe in the support of the public school as one of the cornerstones of American liberty. I believe in the right of every parent to choose whether his child shall be educated in public school or in a religious school supported by those of his own faith. I believe in the principle of non-interference by this country in the internal affairs of other nations, and that we should stand steadfastly against any such interference by whosoever it may be urged. And I believe in the common brotherhood of man under the common fatherhood of God. In this spirit, I join with fellow Americans of all creeds in a fervent prayer that never again in this land will any public servant be challenged because of the faith in which he has tried to walk humbly with his God." Well, this hope, of course, has not been realized. Many in our country are still being challenged because of their faith. Bigotry and intolerance have not completely disappeared, either from the ranks of the Protestants or from the ranks of the Catholics, the Ku Klux Klan, or Jerry K. Smith, or Father Coughlin. Intolerance dies hard. It's always there, hidden away in some dark corner in the souls of some people. And when given an opportunity, it will surge forward, sweep forward, and bedevil a situation. I'm praying that that will not happen. Now, a man should be elected to office because of his character, because of his ability, because of his platform, because of the issues which he represents. not because of his religion. And no man should be defeated from office because of his religion. We have a long way to go. We all have lived in this gracious and blessed land and have been given free opportunities to live our own lives and to worship God as we wish to, Catholic, Protestant, Jew. Let us not endanger that gift, that blessed gift, which we've all enjoyed, by seeking monopolistic privileges, by seeking to dominate, by seeking to appropriate for ourselves what the basic law of our country meant to belong to everyone. We have a long way to go, but if we follow the clear intent and purpose of our Constitution, of our Declaration of Independence, and that the fine men of all faiths who have faithfully and loyally sought to live up to those principles. All of us, whatever our religion, whatever our creed, whatever our race, will be able to move into an even greater and more beautiful day in which all men we live as brothers, worshiping the one true God, each in his own way, each in his own dedication.